Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Keeping It Real with Kennedy. We've got some big conversations about healthcare happening today, so to avoid wasting time, let's just get right into it. So I recently read the book, The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It by Dr. Marty McCary, and it's so clearly laid out the problems I see happening on a daily basis with insurance and healthcare in general at my job and at clinics and hospitals all across the country that I feel like because I have this podcast platform that I personally have the moral and ethical responsibility to share this information with you guys. So as you're probably aware, getting good healthcare that's in network with your insurance that doesn't cost an arm and a leg can be challenging these days, to say the least. Even on the other end, for me as a provider, to get credentialed with insurance companies with my license so that they'll put me in their network to get reimbursed for the care I'm providing is a pain in the ass. The money game of medicine is filled with middlemen, kickbacks, and hidden costs, and we're about to talk all about that. There can be radically different prices for the exact same medical care at the exact same facility by the exact same doctors and nurses, all depending on what kind of insurance you have, if you're lucky enough to even have it at all in the first place. Healthcare is a $3.5 trillion market. Now, I don't think my brain actually comprehends how big that number is. So 1 trillion is 1,000 billions or 1 million millions. So think of $1 million, right? Just think about it. Then think about that number multiplied by itself. So you see a massive pile of 1 million millions, and that gets multiplied by 3.5. Whoa. A buzzword that I think we're going to start seeing a lot more in the coming years is price transparency for medical care. This basically just means that when you go to get a medical procedure done, the hospital or clinic will let you know exactly what you'll be paying flat out, up front, with full transparency and no hidden costs. The Surgery Center of Oklahoma is a great example of this. They have an interactive website where you can select a procedure and it immediately gives you a price estimate for what it'll cost. For example, I selected an ear tube removal, just like at random, and it estimated a total cost of $1,730. This concept is revolutionary in modern healthcare, and there are a lot of people at the top of big traditional insurance companies who don't like it. On the other side of the insurance card, patients everywhere love it. Some patients have even flown all the way from Japan to Oklahoma City for medical treatment at the surgery center. Why? Because it's American medicine with transparent pricing. People are hungry for this. They want to feel genuinely cared for, and caring for them also includes caring for their wallets. Financial harm at this point should be considered a complication of seeking medical care sometimes, and it happens way too often in this country. Big insurance companies and others who are committed to the current broken healthcare system feel threatened by the price transparency model because if it becomes contagious, it would mean that they would need to show their prices as well and compete in a real marketplace. But insurance companies like having their secret discounts and their selective networks. The system is so flawed that California lawmakers actually had to pass a law to prevent insurance companies from retaliating against hospitals that disclose their prices. It's so much of a risk to the insurance company's bottom line for patients to truly know what they're getting that they feel the need to retaliate against hospitals and people doing honest work just telling people what they're getting. That's gross. And you know what else? A 2018 study showed that medical centers who initiated full price transparency saw a 50% increase in patient volume, a 30% increase in revenue, and a statistically significant increase in patient satisfaction. So people are just so sick and tired of playing the insurance game. Have you heard of the funeral rule? It's basically mandatory price transparency for services, but only when you're dead. So ironically, the federal government already has a mandatory disclosure rule for out-of-pocket costs that people incur for funeral homes called the funeral rule, and it was enacted in 1984. And what was their reasoning for this? They claimed that people in a distressing situation should have honest pricing information. Now, as Dr. McCary and I both urge, people seeking surgery and other forms of medical care are, indeed, in a distressing situation. Why do we not honor the living with honesty the same way that we honor the dead? In case you're wondering, your rights under the funeral rule are to buy only the funeral arrangements you want. Oh, but hospitals can hit you with a surprise bill that includes a cheaply made $87 blanket that you didn't even ask for. You also have a right to get price information over the telephone. Have you ever tried to get price information over the phone from a major hospital? Don't waste your time. You also have a right to receive a written statement from the funeral home after you decide what you want and before you pay for it that details every single good and service you have selected and the price of each one. So many patients and hospitals don't even know what goods and services to ask for because they don't know what's going on with their bodies. They just want to feel better and will go along with whatever someone in a white coat tells them to do because inherently they trust their doctor, right? But not all doctors are created equal. The Restoring Medicine Project provides resources to people from all walks of life, from doctors to concerned citizens and community members, to address predatory billing, suing, medical overscreenings, and other unfair healthcare practices in their communities. They also provide reports and statistics so you can see the data and the problem with your own eyes. Their website is restoringmedicine.org, and I'll also link that in the description of this podcast. Now, hospitals have historically been a safe haven for the sick and the injured, but fast forward to 2024, and aggressive billing practices have now eroded much of the public's trust between the medical profession and the community, many of whom avoid going to the doctor or seeking care altogether because they're afraid it's going to cost too much. After hearing about countless lives impacted, credit scores ruined, and people paralyzed by debt more than by the conditions that they sought care for, we must change the ways that our facilities operate if we truly believe in the heart of the Hippocratic Oath. Everyone is so fed up with the system where people in power use their power to take advantage of the people with less power. And that doesn't apply just to healthcare, but industry-wide in America. Quite the American dream we've got going on. So what a lot of people don't know is that it's not just the for-profit hospitals and organizations who are guilty of taking advantage of their patients. So nonprofits and religious-based hospitals doting their mission to care for people just the way Jesus did by providing charity care for free if people qualified were found to be no exception. Every single religious-based and nonprofit hospital that McCary and his team looked into had a history documented of suing patients, garnishing their wages for unpaid, overpriced medical bills that then inflate due to interest and court fees. As McCary said in his book, when you ask what would Jesus do, we're pretty sure that's not it. Mike Hansen, CEO of a rural Nebraska community hospital, said it best. Quote, "In-hospital care is not healthcare. In-hospital care is about 14% of healthcare. The rest is determined by social determinants of health, behaviors, and choices." End quote. Do you guys remember what we learned last week on this podcast about social dynamics and behavior change? I'd recommend that episode next if you're new here today. Anyways, at his rural Nebraskan hospital, occupational and physical therapists partner with 850 businesses in the 25,000-person town to promote healthy living and injury prevention. In this hospital system, if patients need a payment plan, the CEO himself works a deal with the local bank in town to give them a low-interest loan. Then, the hospital backs the debt, so if the patient defaults, it falls back on the hospital and not the patient themselves. Half of their patients are covered by Medicare and Medicaid, yet they still have a good profit margin each year. Many other hospitals in the nation argue that the reason their margins aren't as good is because they have a lot of patients on Medicare and Medicaid, which typically have lower reimbursement rates than other insurance plans. But it seems like that's not a problem in Nebraska for some reason. Interesting. They don't have to overcharge their patients. They don't have to sue them when they can't make ends meet. That is healthcare. Who knew of all places the middle of Nebraska is doing it best? Yeah! Don't even get me started on helicopter life flights. Price gouging in this industry is downright disgusting and predatory. So three large companies control 75% of privately owned for-profit helicopters in the healthcare industry in the United States. Just three companies. So a government study found that charges by air methods, the country's largest air ambulance or helicopter company, increased from $13,000 per average transport in 2007 to $49,800 in 2016. Now I know inflation has been pretty bad the past few years, but that rate of change is straight up out of line. Air Methods is a publicly traded company with over $1 billion in revenue in 2014. Nowadays, private companies typically charge a $30,000 quote-unquote liftoff fee in addition to a fee per mile, and then they send the bill directly to the patient, not to the hospital. There's a lot of hospitals that take the bill themselves. I'm not saying this is all hospitals. I'm just saying, like, this is happening. So from 2010 to 2014, median prices for air ambulance helicopter flights across all companies in the country doubled from $15,000 to $30,000 in just 4 years. You can't tell me that their operating costs and overhead are increasing proportionally to that. But you probably could tell me that their wallets sure are increasing exponentially. In his book, MacRae talks to two good men fighting against this corrupt industry for the benefits of the patients. Dirk Seisser and Jeff Frazier founded a company called Sentinel Air Medical Alliance, committed to price transparency and putting a stop to air ambulance ripoffs. They are committed to transporting any patient in any condition from point A to point B anywhere in the continental U.S. for less than $20,000, guaranteed. If we look at the facts, contrary to popular belief, 80% of air ambulance flights every year in the United States are not actual emergencies, but are more like routine transfers of stabilized patients from one facility to another. So only 20% are real emergencies? Yeah. In other words, for-profit air transfer companies have begun to see a lucrative business in whisking patients away by helicopter when they're in a vulnerable state, not knowing what's wrong with their bodies, being assured that this is necessary to save their lives, only to find out that they could have traveled on the ground for a fraction of the cost and still been in a stable condition. A University of Arizona analysis showed that out of 5,200 trauma patients transferred by helicopter, nearly one-third of them, or 1,733 people, were minimally injured. 1,733 people who didn't need to ride in a helicopter, impacted by debt, maybe taken to collections, and they're not alone. To put things further into perspective, one patient transferred from Montana to Florida woke up one day to a bill for $630,000 for the flight alone. Not to mention the hospital bills and the medical charges and all that. The helicopter that he flew on only sells for $350,000. He could have bought the thing and then hired a pilot for a while. Like, what? That's ridiculous. If you ever find yourself in a situation where medical professionals are telling you that you need to travel by helicopter to a bigger, better facility or whatever their reasoning may be, and if you're stable enough to have a minute to spare, remember, only 20% are real emergencies. Odds are, hopefully, you're in the 80% that isn't an emergency. I want you to call Sentinel Air Medical Alliance. They will use your call to get bids in the industry, and you'll get there for under $20,000 guaranteed. I'll put the link in the description of this podcast. And I know this is all easier said than done. If a true emergency does happen to you, you know, you're not just going to have Air Alliance people on speed dial, right? But it's good to know your options, you know, like you want to know the facts. Like if somebody says something to you, be like, hey, do I have a choice in who I call? Can we call these guys? Maybe they'll say yes. Hopefully they do. Maybe they won't. But I'm hoping you just be informed. Now, I don't say all this to say that all medical helicopters in the industry are corrupt. There are some companies that are for profit and are good and fair, and there's always people that are doing good. But there's always that one guy, meaning that some people with money and power have seen the opportunity to prey on those most vulnerable and financially kill them with outlandish surprise bills that they never asked for, nor do they deserve. The average person is not ready to spend $630,000 on a helicopter ride that they didn't even want in the first place. These powerful people go to great lengths to conceal their bill charges, operating costs, and the availability of lower-costing providers so that they don't even have to participate in any market competition because they're the only ones, right? The patient doesn't know any better. And when they don't get what they want, they don't just garnish wages, but they even go so far as to place liens on the patient's homes because they're charging so much. And when these ordinary people can't pay these massive bills, the remaining balance gets passed on to you and me and the rest of the country in the form of higher health insurance premiums, particularly in rural areas where care can be even harder to receive and find in the first place. This whole concept also applies to ambulance travel on the ground, but I don't even want to get into that right now. It's slowly becoming more popular in the 2020s to take an Uber or a Lyft to the hospital for medical emergencies than it is to call 911. Imagine you're an Uber driver and somebody calls you up and you get in and they're like having a heart attack. That's where we're at, people. What has happened to this country and this system, and how did we get this far gone? Another topic Macquarie discusses is how we measure our quality outcome metrics and KPIs in healthcare. One of the best ways that has been found to keep doctors accountable from ordering unnecessary procedures like C-sections and blood transfusions in people that don't actually need them is to track the data of each individual doctor at the hospital and then compare their individual rates to both the national guidelines and to their peers. Now, doctors are typically competitive by nature. None of us want to be the outlier in the data, that one point representing that one person who's performing too many transfusions or C-sections or whatever the procedure may be in your field that may be considered medically unnecessary. When individuals within systems are tracked over time and notified of their standing among their peers, studies have shown that unnecessary procedure rates plummet time and time again in most cases. Trackable markers can include things like the style and nature of the doctor's practice specialty, the complexity of their patients, their threshold to intervene, the degree of risk they take, their treatment algorithms, what medical codes they're using and billing for, and things like that. Some consensus guidelines for both doctors and patients about the problem of overtreatment can be found through the Choosing Wisely project at choosingwisely.org. The link is in the description. To reiterate, one quality checkpoint of a quality doctor is how well he or she or they discern when medical care is appropriate and when it is not. When to ask another doctor or colleague for advice. When to recognize that a patient is not understanding them. When something they said causes a patient to lose trust in them. Knowing their limits and acting accordingly. This is what will transform the quality of our doctors. As an aside and a promotion for physical therapy, I want to highlight that Macquarie details a discussion with a spine surgeon about what would be something that is overdone in the spine surgery field that they could measure in hopes of leading to positive change. The surgeon immediately replied that, quote, "Some surgeons will inappropriately perform surgery for back pain in patients who have never tried physical therapy. It should always be tried first. If PT fails, then surgery may be necessary," end quote. So if you have back pain, we're all begging you, choose PT first, don't go straight to surgery, and do your exercises if you go to PT. Now, I have a lot of friends out in Washington State. Did you guys know that a detailed report from the Washington Health Alliance looking at 21 physicians found that 45% of Washington State healthcare services were unnecessary? 45%. That's almost one in every two services being completely unnecessary. This abomination cost Washingtonians and Americans an estimated $282 million in just 1 year that they have the data for, not to mention the cost of the lived experiences of these patients who did not need treatment. One thing that really irks me is doctors giving people unnecessary anxieties and scares about normal variants in their bodies, because this can also create anxiety and emotional trauma, thus leading to possible mental health problems that then require further treatment for something that was never harmful and should have never even been a discussion in the first place. As healthcare professionals, we have to do and be better. Luckily, some people are. So Iora Health is a company that is doing just that. Founded by Dr. Rushika Fernandopoul, they have a unique relationship-based approach to healthcare that is restoring humanity to medicine and lowering healthcare costs. One of the best parts? They don't even have a billing office or a business area to process insurance claims, because there aren't any. In its place, they have extra space to hold yoga, fitness, or educational classes for their patients and their community. Their providers and health coaches have the freedom and autonomy to do whatever they feel is best for the patient to promote their health. They even provide things like ride services to cooking classes and fighting the modern-day loneliness epidemic. They provide game nights and community events for lonely seniors. Since Macquarie's book was published, Iora Health has been bought out and rebranded to One Medical. I'll link their website in the description. They currently have 25 locations across the United States and more on the way. So switching topics, have you ever heard of an insurance broker or know what their job description entails? So big insurance companies pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in commission and bonuses to their individual brokers that they often employ themselves, who work to encourage contracted employers to stick to higher costing health insurance plans. This commission-based model is yet another working piece of our broken system. Demand is now increasing for insurance brokers who use a flat fee model that is more aligned with what's best for employers, akin to price transparency, not in line with the big insurance companies. Employers are sick of the games too, you know? Brokers who charge a flat fee make their commission based on how much is saved for their employer instead of how much is spent by the employer. Now that's a win-win. There's a lot of insurance brokers that are good, you know? I'm not saying the whole industry is corrupt. I'm saying there are people who are corrupt in this industry, and it is changing for the better. Health Rosetta is a company that's disrupting this business game of employer-sponsored benefits for the better. They aim to educate employers on how to buy health insurance based on its true value rather than by hidden broker kickbacks and bonuses. I'll link their website in the description if you are an employer looking for a way to lower your insurance costs. Next time your business buys health insurance, ask if the broker is Health Rosetta certified or if it follows the principles of full disclosure and fair trade that Health Rosetta outlines on their website. Now, have you ever heard of a pharmacy benefit manager? These guys are behind the often high costs of many necessary medications. Many people falsely blame the individual pharmacies themselves, but it's often the benefits manager who should be caught red-handed. So here's how it works. An employer has a pharmacy benefits manager who does exactly what it sounds like they do. They manage the company's pharmacy benefits for their employees. Employers are sent sometimes 100-page-long documents listing all the medications their employees are taking, how many of them are taking the medications, what each dosage costs, all leading up to one very big lump sum at the bottom with the total cost of all the medications for their employees. Employers are often told that they're getting 10 and 20% discounts to keep them happy, but what they don't know is that these pharmacy benefits managers jack up the rates 5 to 20 times as high as what they pay the pharmacy for that medication. So think of them as the middleman between the employer and the pharmacy itself. The benefits manager purchases all the medications directly from the pharmacy and completely legally jacks up the rate to whatever they want to. Then they charge their customer, the employer of the business, an inflated rate for all the medications. A lot of the more common medications are often fully covered by the employee or the patient's copay, meaning that the pharmacy benefits manager middleman pays absolutely nothing to the pharmacy for that medication. So it's free for them to give to the employer and the business, right? Wrong. The pharmacy benefits manager will then charge the employer, for example, a rate of $188.88, as cited in one example from the book, that actually should have been free, but then they'll tell the employer they got it at a 10% discount. How's the employer to know any better? They just got charged almost $200 for something that was absolutely free and then led to believe that they were getting a deal and a discount. That's sick. So in these cases, the pharmacists and pharmacies themselves are stuck with the public blame because they're held to a contract with the pharmacy benefits manager to not disclose what they're truly charging them as a pharmacy, and they can't say what the pharmacy benefits manager actually paid them. This contract allows the benefits manager to be free to hike the cost up by 1,000%, and nobody would be the wiser. The pharmacy doesn't know what they charge the business, and the business doesn't know what they pay the pharmacy. The employers just have to pay it without question, because the system is so confusing to navigate that it's often easier as an employer to just not ask questions. They already have enough on their plate with running a business and everything. At smaller independent pharmacies, losing their large contracts with benefits managers could put them out of business. To put this topic in perspective, about 80% or 4 in 5 Americans today get their medications through a pharmacy benefits manager, whether they know it or not. People love to play the blame game and point the finger at big pharma bad guys like Martin Shkreli, but the true criminals are lurking right at the doorsteps of your businesses, talking with you over lunch or dinner in the form of pharmacy benefits managers. I'm not saying every pharmacist benefits manager is bad. A lot of them are very good. You know, I'm just saying this is happening. I feel like that's my disclaimer for everything I'm saying. It's like, it's not all bad, but there's some bad. So why don't businesses start asking more questions and doing more research, you may be thinking. The reason that employers of American businesses aren't negotiating better rates with their pharmacy benefits managers is because often the health insurance companies that cover them are in cahoots with the benefits managers. There are often these big co-owned companies with the insurance company making their profits from both the drug markups and their in-house benefit managers, as well as on like the ambulances and all the other markups, you know, like it's all a game. A 2017 analysis showed that reducing generic reimbursement by just $1 per prescription would lower healthcare spending by $5.6 billion annually. For just $1 a pop, what was it, $3.5 trillion industry, $5.6 billion. If we did like $5, that's like, I don't know, we could do a little dent. Like the solutions are there. What we need are courageous people to say enough of the money games. Let's be a country and a people of solutions for ourselves. The whole world is watching us, you know? The State Auditor of Ohio found that in 2018, the profits of the pharmacy benefit manager middlemen cost the state's Medicaid program $224 million in just a single year. All of their $250 million profits were paid out of our collective pockets with taxpayer money. The National Community Pharmacists Association pleads that if you want to reduce prescription drug costs, policymakers must demand greater transparency from pharmacy benefits managers. I couldn't agree more. If we want to just keep going in more directions here, there is evidence that certain wellness programs encouraged and sponsored by employers actually violate the Americans with Disabilities Act, which prohibits employers from conducting medical exams and collecting histories of their employees unless they're voluntary. What started as a well-intentioned movement, the quote-unquote wellness industry, is now becoming a slippery slope with some serious legal concerns. Some studies are coming out showing that wellness isn't even beneficial in the first place. A 2019 clinical trial of 32,974 employees showed no significant benefit from a wellness program, focusing on 8 modules in nutrition, physical activity, stress reduction, and related topics. So again, on top of legal concerns, these wellness programs don't even work in the long run. Again, remember what we just learned last week about behavior change? You can't just make your employees do this program and just give them the facts and expect everything to change. People don't respond to facts anymore. You can't just say, like, wellness luncheon, we're going to learn about nutrition while we have some Panera bread. If you want your employees, your employers, your friends, your family, if you want people to just generally be healthier and like want wellness, you need to invest in them socially, emotionally, mentally, physically. It's about the whole person. You can't just say, we're going to do wellness if somebody's not interested. Remember the stages of behavior change we talked about last week? If they're in the pre-contemplation stage, they're just going to think it's a load of crap that their boss is making them do because they just have to check off the box so they can send it to whoever that this is a good place to work and all that kind of stuff. I'll cite the article about the wellness study in the description if you're interested. I hate to say this, but I think the wellness industry is just the next pharmaceutical industry. It's wrapped nicely in a bow. Like it looks nicer because it's under the guise of like wellness, and they sell you low-fat diets and health advice and, you know, healthy habits. I feel torn because I do believe in wellness. Like I think it's important, but like you just have to do it right. Like everything we said last week applies right here. You gotta do it right. For an example, Al Lewis of the company Quizify says that most of what we pay for in wellness programs is just expensive fluff. And I think that's kind of what I'm trying to like get at. So Quizify uses the Choosing Wisely program that I previously mentioned to teach the general public about common medical pitfalls, like the risks of overscreening and overtreatment, in a game show type format. So they educate large groups of people, they come to your businesses, and they teach you anything from like how to read a nutrition label to how long a knee replacement lasts, things like that. So their goal is to make people and employees and employers wiser stewards of their own health and consequently of their healthcare spending. Their founder describes their vibe as Jeopardy meets Comedy Central. So not all wellness programs are a money grab, you know, like this one sounds really good. But when choosing one, make sure you look at the science backing it and at the possible motivation of the person selling it to you. Do they really have you and your employees' best interests in mind? A lot of wellness programs are great. Wellness is important. We have a lot of mental health problems in this country, and we need wellness. But behavior change is tricky. And go listen to last week's episode, and then this one, and then maybe we'll be on the right track. At the end of the day, people like to play the blame game. The American people blame the arrogance of the people at the top. They blame infections, doctors, hospitals, payers, big pharma, medical device companies, and anything at all that they can reasonably think of for the brokenness of the system that we live in. Healthcare is one of today's most divisive, territorial, political, and human issues. Margaret Mead once said, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." So please join me in this call to action as a society. We need to do better. We need to be better. Our lives are actually at stake. This isn't a partisan issue. This is an American issue as a whole. All of us, regardless of your opinions, political stance, race, gender, or any other defining characteristic. Okay, well, you guys are in luck this week because we had it in the budget to get one of the nation's hottest experts on healthcare onto the podcast this week to help us further discuss this topic and the issues at hand. So everyone, please give a warm welcome to Mrs. Denise Hawley. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It sounds like you've been reading the book that I just read, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and how far have you gotten into it?
Chapter 5.
Okay, and what do you think so far?
I think it's a light that needs to be shined.
I agree. Okay, so I've prepared us some questions. We can kind of diverge from the questions if we need to, but let's go ahead and get right into it. So this isn't super about the book to start with, but in your personal experience, how have you seen healthcare change overall from the time you were younger until now?
Oh, wow. When I was younger, I was in a Kaiser type system in California. And then when we moved to Washington, it was different. It was more of a family practice. And in that family practitioner delivered babies. They did the colonoscopies in office. They drew the blood in office. There weren't a lot of extra people. Everything was just done in office. So that definitely has changed. When I was 18, one of my first jobs as a quote unquote adult was working in a pharmacy. And stopped when I was in my late 40s, early 50s. Mm-hmm. So in that time, a lot of the changes I've seen relate to pharmaceutical. When electronic billing started happening, you would submit a prescription to the insurance company. You know, they'd send you back the information of whether it was approved or not, for how many days and what the cost would be. And the first rejection I received, that they didn't want to pay for that medication. The patient had to take this one, happened to be actually a birth control, and the patient needed to take a different birth control medication. Mm-hmm. And I was absolutely livid, because when did the insurance company get its medical license?
Right.
And the pharmacist I was working with, he said, I've been hearing some rumbling. This is just the beginning. And then it went to like cholesterol medication and thyroid medication. And those are ones that you should not change back and forth, even between brand and generic. So it was just mind blowing at that point in time. And in the mid-90s, I actually met with senators and a couple of different groups in regards to the elevation that was happening in pharmacies, because at that point in time, another new niche was that drug companies were buying up the raw product, which would then elevate not just the brand medication, but the generic product itself. I mean, it was very disheartening. They were trying to work on some laws, but they never really got to the root of the challenge. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's still a lot of corruption. What is it? Padding of pockets, I guess would be the terminology that was going on. There was big lawsuits and bribe-taking revealing that was going on in the FDA at that point in time. So, you know, the theory was when that gets all settled, then they'll leave in things out, and it hasn't.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah.
In 6 months' time, I saw an increase of a lot of medications, like some 500-700%.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And they were generics. So it was frustrating.
Yeah. That's very informative, for sure. So switching topics a little bit, I'm just wondering if there's anything that stuck out to you that you agreed with or disagreed with, either from hearing the episode so far or from the book that you've read.
I think there's some things that need to be said a little bit more in detail. There have been some laws that have been put into place, like the surprise medical billing law. I haven't read the whole thing, but it has been accepted nationwide now. There were only a couple of states that had it. Another law that's been adopted is where medical collections, if they're under $500, they're not supposed to affect your credit at all.
Okay.
And there are two states, New York and Colorado, that have not put a dollar amount on medical that will affect your credit. And those are recent. Those happened at the end of 23. So there has been some movement. I am just so excited that there are doctors within the industry that are putting the light on it, because they'll get listened to. People that are, you know, just assistants or utilizers of the industry are not going to have as much power in their voice as a physician, mm-hmm, or a surgeon.
Yeah. There's always new things happening, but it's important to shed light on it. And then we can actually talk about it. You know, like nobody's talking about it.
Yes. Exactly. I remember my father had a kidney transplant in 1990, and it was super early in the morning. And so you enter through the emergency room and the hospital side of administration, not the inpatient. You enter through the ER. Mm-hmm. Well, because of that, the billing was done wrong. And at that point in time, my parents had four insurances. My parents ended up getting sued for $10,000.
Oh my gosh.
And they lost. When I was listening to the book, I was like, oh, now I understand why mom and dad lost that case, because the HIPAA laws had just come into play at that point in time.
Oh.
And so they were not very well understood. And so I'm sure that the judge got some redacted form of what happened. And with dad being admitted, he literally walked in through the ER and went up to the surgery floor. He was never seen, evaluated, no, not even any blood pressure or anything was taken.
Oh my gosh.
So I guess one of the things that I would like to express to people, don't just blindly pay it, read it, understand it. Mm-hmm. Now, I know there are facilities that it's not within their purview to care. Mm-hmm. They're like, no, this is what I was told to do. Or they might be new at the job and they really don't have the depth of understanding. Don't ever be afraid to ask to speak to another person.
Yeah, well, it's confusing too. Like, you don't even know what questions to ask. What's even going on? Like, how did this happen?
Yes. there was this surgery that I had at Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, and it was an experimental application of the surgery. Basically, what the surgery was severing nerves around an organ. And so they were experimenting it used on people with my condition. That part of the whole thing was supposed to be taken care of by the hospital itself because it was a medical research situation. But then the hospital stay would then be on my side, you know, mm-hmm. So there's a split bill basically. And our insurance approved it because it was not an experimental surgery. And so I knew that we would pay 20%, but our maximum out of pocket at that point in time, I think was $2,000. Mm-hmm. So when we received a bill in the mail for $12,000, I was like, excuse me,
what?
This is not what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
And I will say that the billing department at Mayo at that point in time was fabulous. They did get me an itemized bill.
Okay.
And it was a thick brick printed out on like an old dot matrix printer, which honestly surprised me because this was in 2010, I think. So I went by each line item and there were so many things on there that were just standard billing. I could not walk for the first 3 or 4 days. I think it was the day that I walked was the day that I left the hospital mm-hmm. and got on an airplane that night. They billed me for an oxygen canister and one of those portable roll around things. So they literally billed for every individual thing. They billed for the canister, they billed for the tubing, and they billed for the little
and
cart.
Like a little roller for it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And so with that, I was like, didn't use any of those. Because when you're in the bed, they charge you for a different type of oxygen canister. Because you could, right. I could see those statements on the lines. And yes, it did take a lot of Googling into figuring out different words. But having some medical background with just all the surgeries that our family has gone through and then being in pharmacy for a while, I was able to filter it pretty well. So when I called and I spoke to the billing department, because I went through and highlighted all these things that I wanted to talk about, they're like, well, we can't just take these off. I said, well, you can call back to the ward and find out, because I literally was throwing up and I could not get out of bed for like 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
And so they did end up taking them off, and they had not billed my insurance as to why that bill was so high.
Oh, okay.
And so they did take those things off and then bill the insurance. The other thing on that bill that just shocked me is that at that point in time, there was medication that had just been out for not very long. It was Zofran. And to sell it in the pharmacy, it was well over $700 for one pill.
Whoa. And
yeah. It was when it first came out, and I had to take some of those. They tried those on me because of the perpetual vomiting. And the hospital was only charging me like $45 a pill. And in my mind, all I thought was, okay, that can't be right.
Right.
There's no way that could be right. And for a pain medication, they were charging like $112 a pill. So
that doesn't add up.
No, working in pharmacy and seeing what those costs of those medications were that the pharmacy paid for them, and then again, what the customer paid for them, it was like, okay, wait a minute. And so the reality of the pharmacy broker type of situation that the book was talking about really just popped open in my eyes right at that point in time. When I had a nephrectomy here in Greenville, their definition of an itemized bill was not down to every tablet. It was like, you're in the hospital this day, you stayed this day. This is your daily charge.
Like a lump sum for the day, yes, kind of a thing.
Yes. And I had to call and request for it to be more itemized. I want to know the number of milliliters of anesthesia that went through and, you know, all of those, like how many tubings did I use or how many surgical packets do they have to open is basically what it comes down to, that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. So that if they had to open 10 to 15 surgical packets, I'm like, okay, wait a minute. Was there a bleeder? What's going on here? Is there something I wasn't aware of, or is this just inflated cost?
Yeah, that's a good point too.
Yeah. So you just have to be your own advocate when it comes not just to your medical health, but nowadays to the billing. Like when you're in a medical situation, regardless of whether you have a lot of experience in those type of situations or not, you feel like you're out on a desert island. There's like no resources. Lots of times sickness robs your brain of logic. I mean, you really do need an advocate, and an advocate not just to speak to your medical professionals and to really search for, is this the best procedure for you? But from the medical billing perspective, it is so frustrating. Even as my mom aged, they usually were lab bills that she would get in the mail. And the way that they wrote the invoice was so frustrating to me, because down at the bottom, they would have a pay now bill due total that was before her insurance. They automatically sent them out every month. And somebody who came from that era especially was like, I need to pay this bill. I'm tired of having this bill come at me in the mail.
Right.
But underneath it, in tiny little writing, it would say still pending insurance payment, or I can't remember what the exact terminology was. But
right. So it seems like they're just trying trying to get you to pay it before they even have to do the work of the insurance, so they can bank on you paying more, and then they're in the positive, you know?
Yes. The facility in Washington State that we've utilized and that has garnished wages multiple times is MultiCare. And that was years ago when the kids were little, because our youngest had multiple surgeries and most everything that was done with him at Children's was taken care of financially between our co-pays and then the program that the hospital had. But at MultiCare facility, where they would run different tests and sometimes sleep studies and things like that, those were billed erratically. And if you did not have the bill paid within 11 months, it would go to a garnishment.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, there was no grace. Then that's the other side that I learned. A wise friend, she said, just send them $5 a month, because if you are continually paying toward the bill, they can't take you to collections. But in some states, it's a percentage. It just really depends on the laws of the state. Mm-hmm. And those laws, people are like, well, why would I need to know all these laws, like the intricacy of them? And unfortunately, you find out you need to know them when you run into a situation. I remember being bullied one time by a debt collector in regards to a dental bill. And this was back in the late 80s. On the phone, the collector was able to say things. They're just illegal now. Like at that point in time, my husband was a forklift driver, but very brand new to the job. And she said to me, oh, come on, your husband's a forklift driver. You can pay more than $5 a month.
What?
Like, yeah, literally, that's what she said.
That's crazy.
I was like, she went there.
Yeah.
And I mean, now at my age and just the knowledge that I've gained over the years, I would have put her in her place. I mean, I wouldn't have been rude, but I still would have been pointed and factual.
No, but you can't let her get away with that, you know?
Yeah, but because I was young, I was in my early 20s, I had a small toddler. We were trying to get it to where I could stay home with him, but I was still working. It was a big challenge. And it was because of a dental bill that was $3,000. Mm-hmm. And that was another thing, that was the first time I had an experience learning about insurance and understanding the limits. Because when we got married, it was the first time my husband had dental coverage. This dental bill did not include an extraction at all. This was just cleaning and fillings and adjustings. And the dental office just said, this needs to be done. And so Chris just kept making appointments and they never gave us any estimates of like how much it would cost at first. Now, I think the dental industry has gotten a whole lot better with that. And that I'm super thankful for, because letting you know up front is huge when it comes to the dental perspective. And I feel like that crisis in our finances really opened my eyes to learning. And I think we've advanced as a society in that side. We just need to carry that over to the medical side.
Yeah.
I will say the last surgery I had, they did give me a, this is what you're going to owe at the end of the surgery. It was inaccurate, but they tried. Really, it wasn't outlandish, but I had already met my maximum out of pocket. So there should have been no cost. So in the book, it talks about a pharmacy broker when speaking of how much an employer pays for medications or for insurance. And so an employer gets to decide, you know, that they're not going to cover drug A, they're going to cover drug C in a particular category type of deal. First of all, that shocked me, because with the HIPAA laws, how does a pharmacy broker get access to that information? Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I've seen happening for my husband's employment, as well as a couple of my kids, is that they'll be offered like $300 or $500 to go into a healthcare spending or savings account if they answer some health questions, or if they go into a wellness program through the employer. And looking at it from the billing perspective, it seems to me like it's a bait and switch, because if somebody is answering questions, they're not like yes or no questions, like do you smoke or do you not smoke? Do you drink alcohol or do you not drink alcohol? A lot of employers ask those in this wellness category, because those statistics and numbers play toward their premiums being less.
Yeah.
But they'll ask other questions like, are your parents still alive? Which is a huge trigger when it comes to statistical analysis in life expectancy and how much medical care a person needs. So you can get into a slippery slope with these things. I mean, and at first my antenna went up when the company my husband worked for at the time was starting to venture down that road. And honestly, the only thing that I was like, go ahead and answer the smoke and drinking questions. But other than that, we're not involved. We're just going to avoid that, because one of my challenges is a hereditary disease. And so I was taught as a child that you don't say anything until it shows up in your medical records, because it's huge in regards to life insurance. And one of the things that is a blessing about getting insurance through a company is they can't penalize you and you pay a higher premium because of the history of your family.
Right.
There is one thing that a lot of people in your age group don't think about, which is life insurance, because you will pay a whole lot less when your parents are still alive. It's a huge marker for life insurance. Unfortunately, my husband lost both of his parents early, but if you don't get life insurance until after that, you either are not getting a lot, your insurance will go down, or your premium will go up. I mean, there's no crossing the line there. It does take a little bit of time to think about it. You know, you're never guaranteed the next day. So when you talk about medical and the insurance industry, knowing the tricks and paths around it really is about knowledge and acting upon that knowledge. Just be proactive in it.
Yeah, I agree.
There was a period of time when just with the immediate five in my family, not counting my mom and dad, in 10 years, there were 15 surgeries. That's not like procedures and blood draws.
Yes, that's like a big deal.
Yeah, that's like actual surgeries. So I have experience when it comes to billing. And actually, I've tried to send that on to my kids early. Oh, big tip, huge tip for anybody who is, again, young people between the ages of 18 and 30 or so. When you are not attached, you have no spouse, and you're 18, even if you're still in high school, if you go into surgery, you are your own adult. And if there comes up a question while you're in surgery, they can't do anything until you've recovered and come out. And so it would potentially mean another surgery. Mm. So basically have a medical power of attorney to someone at that age.
I don't think a lot of 18-year-olds are thinking about that.
No. And my youngest at the time was still in high school, had a surgery, but was 18. Well, in the surgery, the doctor saw something else that should probably be corrected and couldn't do anything because we did not have a signed consent from my youngest for me to speak on his behalf. So that's just something that usually it's not thought about until you need it and then it's too late. So for people in that niche of life, it's an important piece.
Yeah, I think I've got a lot of listeners in that niche. So I hope y'all are listening. Anyways, that was a good tip. Do you have any final words of wisdom, advice, things like that?
I would just say, be your advocate. And if you get tired of being your advocate, confide in someone and let them know you need help, because that is huge. And it is okay to be tired and it's okay to need help. We're here to be a community and to work together and to learn from each other. And I just think in doing so, just to honor our creator by helping each other out, even if you've gone through a hard time, that hard time can be turned around into helping someone else so that they don't have to have quite the challenge that you did.
Right. I agree. Those are some good words of wisdom. And so last up, you're giving us the fun fact of the week. Is that right?
I'm going to try. I don't know if people think it's fun or weird, but a lot of people don't know that when you get a kidney transplant, quote unquote, they technically don't take out an old kidney. It's a rare occurrence. So they put one in. So it's pretty common for transplanted people to have three kidneys, but the highest number where somebody has had transplants in their native kidneys, there's a person out there with seven kidneys.
Imagine. You might have even seen him on the street one day. We don't know who he is. There's some guy walking around there with seven kidneys. Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Absolutely.
It's been great. Okay, so you heard it here first. We are now doing a fun fact of the week segment on this podcast. So tune in next week for the next installment. Wow, what an episode. I hope you all learned something because I know I did. And with that, we'll see you next Monday.